You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the State Department of Natural Resources has taken criticism in recent years for cutbacks in research and education staff and for rolling back its public presence. We'll learn about retired conservationists who are looking to fill that void with their new group, Wisconsin's Green Fire.
First, in the past several weeks, President Trump has begun to call for an end to the legislative filibuster in the Senate. And this year, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made the decision to use the so-called nuclear option and get rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations.
Democrats did the same during President Obama's time in the White House to move forward federal judicial appointments. So far, the Senate doesn't seem to have an appetite to kill off the legislative filibuster. But as politics becomes more partisan, our guest sees the potential for a slippery slope.
Jennifer Steinhauer joins us now. She wrote about the issue for the New York Times, where she covers Congress and domestic policy. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Jennifer, what's the philosophy behind the filibuster in the first place?
Well, if you look at the difference between the Senate and the House, the House is all about the majority. And the Senate, the minority, actually has quite a bit of power to hold up legislation in ways they can't do it in the House, and to block legislation. The idea is that it's, you know, it's referred to in law as a cooling saucer, where you can take some of the ideas that may emanate from the executive branch of the House and bring sort of the middle ground by having a pretty high vote threshold to pass. Now, the notion that every bill needs 60 votes to pass is not exactly true. You need 60 votes to get on the bill, and a lot of times historically, the Senate hasn't bothered with that. They've gone ahead and just unanimous consent moved on to things. That stopped with the partisan gridlock, where the 60 vote threshold is constantly used by the minority party to try and block things and enforce issues. So this was going on, as you alluded to earlier, when President Obama was in office and Republicans were blocking all of his nominees. Harry Reid, then the majority leader, moved to drop that 60-vote threshold for everything below the Supreme Court. And so what happened is, when Trump won, Republicans took over the Senate, they turned the tables, and they pushed through basically all of his nominees without that threshold. But it stuck there for a while until, of course, they came into the fight over Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court. Democrats made it clear they weren't going to let him through, and so now Majority Leader Mitch McConnell turned that into dropped the threshold there. And now President Trump, as you said at the top there, wants him to extend that to legislation. And that's something where Mitch McConnell has said, that's a bridge too far. We're not going to do that.
And this is something that the president began, it seems like, to call for around the time of the failure of the repealing the health care, repealing and reforming health care. But it is something that it's been something he's continued to say over the weeks, that he wants to end the legislative filibuster. In specific, what do you know about what the president is calling for there?
Well, in some ways, that was very strange that he did that, because the health care law, as well as the attempts to reform the tax code, which will be coming up when the Congress reconvenes next week, are being done through a process called reconciliation, which also does not require 60 votes. We're almost not dealing with anything with 60-vote threshold at this point. So it was a little unclear as to why he seized on that during that debate. That was not the reason it failed. They couldn't get enough Republicans to get on board, even with Mike Pence standing by to break a tie there, as you know, as Senator Susan Collins of Maine, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Arizona, and finally Senator John McCain of Arizona put their thumbs down on that. So that had nothing to do with 60 votes. It was quite confusing as to why he seized on that. But he has since decided that Democrats are blocking their agenda otherwise, and he wants, even though 60 votes have not been needed to do most of the stuff he wants, not to roll back regulations for the most part, not to get his appointees, not to get a Supreme Court nominee, and not to get health care tax reform. So it's a little unclear why he's obsessing over this, since it hasn't really stymied him that much. But I think moving forward, he wants to just make sure that Democrats can't block his legislative agenda, assuming, it's a big assumption, that he can get all Republicans on board with him. And that's not always going to be the case, as we've seen. Mitch McConnell understands that the majority today can be the minority tomorrow, and they don't want the tables turned where Democrats can do comprehensive prescriptive policy without 60 votes. So that's where they stand on that.
So looking at the president's call to end the legislative filibuster, as you said, Mitch McConnell said, no, that's too far. Senator John McCain has said, no, that's not. That's why we're the Senate and not the House. But is there any sort of appetite in the Senate for this?
I think there's very little. I'll tell you where there's appetite for it is in the House. They've really been pushing some very conservative Republicans in the House. Have been complaining about this and grousing about the Senate, which is also obviously part of Washington tradition. They would like to see it happen. There probably obviously would be some support, as there is for everything, even bills that only get two votes have two votes. I could see there with some of the stronger Trump supporters in the Senate, but nothing probably large enough to pass muster in the Senate, and I'm not even sure Mitch McConnell will even bring up such an effort, because not only does he not philosophically believe in it, not only does he think it's a dangerous precedent and something that was not good for his party to do, but he's not particularly supportive of the entire Trump agenda at this point. You know, Trump, for example, is looking at money for a wall at the border with Mexico. That doesn't have unanimous support with Republicans. He would like to see perhaps a dumping of the majority rules of the 60-vote threshold, perhaps at some point for getting that. That's not something I can see Mitch McConnell at this point anyway supporting.
Jennifer Steinhauer is with us right now, reporter from the New York Times, and she's talking with us about President Trump's repeated calls to end the legislative filibuster. And Jennifer, why do you think conditions have been so ripe to take an axe to the filibuster on both sides of the aisle in the last 10 years or so?
Well, the minority always can grouse about that from some positions of the more fringe elements because they, the majority rather, because they don't want the minority stopping their agenda, particularly when it's the president's agenda. But really, in terms of the Senate and the recent moves that were made, begun by Harry Reid, there was a great frustration that the president was not able to get the judicial nominees that they needed, and there was a sense that there was, court backlog, and this was having repercussions for the entire judiciary. And there is a general consensus, at least theoretically, with lawmakers, that the president should have the right to his cabinet, should have the right to his picks. The Supreme Court's a little different. That's farther, stronger scrutiny, but that the president should be yielded to. And obviously, we have a very different kind of president and a very different political climate at this point, and Democrats are not so eager to give him as much discretion, although, again, because of moves made by Harry Reid, they've been unable to stop a lot of it. So just as basically as you already know how partisan D.C. has become and how vitriolic and frankly divided in some ways the whole entire politics of our country have become, there's an increasing inability for both sides to come together and an increasing ability or desire to block the other side from being able to stymie the majority's agenda.
Jennifer, let's just imagine for a minute that unforeseen things happen and the Senate, for whatever reason, becomes amenable to ending the legislative filibuster. What happens then? What does Congress look like and how does it function?
Well, that would be really interesting. Basically, ostensibly what should happen when you have one-party rule in Washington from the White House and Congress is that the president would have a legislative agenda that would basically be rubber-stamped by his own party. But the funny thing about that is if you took this highly controversial and rather groundbreaking move with Republicans who in many ways are uneasy with their president at this point, I'm not even sure that it would necessarily be that effective. It would just depend on policy by policy. Now, if you fast forward and there was a change in leadership in the Senate, for example, if in the what it looks to be at this point, unlike the cases the Democrats retook the Senate, and if you then had a Democrat in the White House at some point, then you're looking at a whole different scenario, especially if you ever had Democratic rule in Washington again, if that ever happened. Then you'd be talking about a complete sea change where they'd be rolling back Republican policies and possibly instituting long-term left-wing policies that would be pretty hard to undo because, frankly, what Democrats tend to embrace are expansions of entitlements, which are really, really hard to unravel, as President Trump learned when his own party tried to repeal Obamacare. So it would be definitely very disruptive, but perhaps not in ways the White House would perceive.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Steinhauer is a reporter at the New York Times, where she covers politics and domestic policy, looking at President Trump's repeated calls to end the legislative filibuster.
When Kathy Stepp resigned this week as Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources, Governor Walker hailed her as a, quote, strong, trusted reformer. However, others have been critical of the direction the department took in recent years as it scaled back its public presence and laid off scientists and educators.
Earlier this year, a group of retired DNR employees and researchers from around the state came together to form Wisconsin's Green Fire. The group plans to fill the void left by cuts to the DNR, from public outreach to testifying at legislative hearings.
Terry Dalton is the co-coordinator of Wisconsin's Green Fire and a former biologist with the DNR and former park ranger with the National Park Service. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Paul LaLiberty, Green Fire board member. He retired from the DNR after 36 years of management and field work in water programs in western and northern Wisconsin. Paul, thanks to you as well.
Well, it's great to be here.
Well, Terry, how did the conversations about creating this organization of scientists and former DNR employees get started?
Well, you know, it started shortly after the elections last November, when Scott Pruitt was named to be the head of the EPA, and a number of us were really concerned about the directions we saw, not only in our state but in the nation, with regard to listening to science in terms of public policy. And it really started as an email chain from a bunch of folks who were concerned, saying, gee, you know, we really need to get together and do something. Here we have all this expertise in recently retired DNR staff, as well as people from other agencies and the universities. Maybe it's time that we stepped up to the plate and tried to get science back on the top of the agenda, at least here in our home state.
And Terry, where did the name Wisconsin's Green Fire come from?
Well, for those who are familiar with Wisconsin's long conservation legacy, they'll know we have a lot of leaders from our state, probably the most famous of whom is Aldo Leopold. And in the last few years, Leopold has become increasingly well-known for his essay, which quoted the term Green Fire. And in fact, there was a film that came out about his life with that title. Basically, he is the father of modern wildlife management and has had a great deal to do with the establishment of natural resources management. And he had an essay in which he talked about the green fire in the eye of a wolf as it died, as the animal actually perished, and talked about how he started to realize the connections of the ecosystem, that everything is connected together and that all the parts are interdependent. So we're kind of playing on Aldo Leopold's legacy and trying to get people to think about the strong conservation heritage we've had here in Wisconsin for many, many years.
Paul, one of the key issues for Green Fire seems to be the importance of science-based decision-making. Can you talk about why you see that as being so important?
Well, Wisconsin has long been a leader on incorporating science into natural resources decision-making, but some recent examples are really quite disturbing on that. For example, the policies in effect now that if legislative bill author or the committee head don't request DNR to appear at a hearing, then DNR doesn't show up, no matter how many members of that committee would like to hear from DNR. So we had legislation on chronic wasting disease and on changing wardens' authorities get debated, and DNR was never asked to give an opinion on what that would mean for those practices in the state of Wisconsin.
So what does the public lose, do you think, when scientists and researchers with the DNR and elsewhere aren't at the table?
Well, the decisions are made based on philosophy, and they may be contrary to science, and that's just not a good way to manage natural resources.
Terry, what sorts of activities will members of Wisconsin's Green Fire be doing? What is the group actually going to be doing?
Well, we're hoping to be able to provide good scientific information to the public, to policymakers and leaders at a local and statewide level. But things like writing white papers, providing press releases, perhaps appearing at public hearings to testify, helping local citizens with issues when they're within our capability, basically getting that science information into the hands of people who really want to use it in decision-making. I think most people understand the importance of science, and they just need to have better access to it and an easy way to understand that science when it's given to them.
We're talking to Terry Dalton and Paul LaLiberty, both involved with Wisconsin's Green Fire. It's a group of former researchers, scientists from the DNR and elsewhere, trying to fill what they see as a void now in science-based research on natural resources issues in Wisconsin. And Terry, can you talk about how cuts at the state level have affected what the DNR can do?
Well, I'm sure most people here in the state have heard about the cuts to the Science Services Bureau, that most of the scientists were eliminated from the state. There's been a lot of cuts also in other areas. Regulatory positions have been cut, education positions. One of my favorite areas to think about is education of our young people. And, you know, we need to have educators out there who are informed on the environment so that future generations coming up have a good understanding of natural resources so they can participate in decision-making when they're in a position to be adults. So I think there's a whole range of areas where the DNR has been cut, and we need to make sure that people still have those resources available to them.
And Paul, staying with that idea of education and research, the DNR has been criticized for cuts to public outreach, the attempt in the state budget to shut down the Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine, lowering the department's presence at the state fair. The state, the governor and others had said they wanted employees to focus on their core duties. Do you consider public outreach to be a key part of what the DNR does?
Well, I think most organizations that have some law enforcement responsibilities take both a proactive and a reactive approach. The reactive is to go out there and find violations and make fines and things. The proactive approach is through education, to get out there and inform people of the laws, tell them why they exist, so that the people that want to comply with the laws know what they are and will do that. And the other thing that comes along with that, with DNR, is there are people out there who want to try to make their lifestyle decisions with a low impact on the land, and so our education programs help people know how to do that. And one of the really good examples of that is the invasive species program. If we confine ourselves to a few citations to people who are hauling weeds around on their trailers or putting some water in their live wells, we're not going to be preventing as much introduction as we are with an education program. That's the way to deal with invasive species. Don't wait until they're already there and find somebody. You need to get out in front of that particular issue.
Terry, critics of the DNR over the years, over the decades for that matter, have said, you know, the DNR overreaches. They may be doing good stuff, but they go too far. It limits economic activity in the state, limits property owners' rights, things like that. What do you say to concerns about that for people who want to see cuts like this at the DNR?
Well, you know, every agency or organization will have areas where they can improve. But if you look at the reputation of the Wisconsin DNR in the nation, we used to be ranked amongst the very top, highest level of performance. And I think that, you know, even though folks would like to see fewer regulations, in many ways, regulations are important for protecting the things that we all care about: water quality, air quality, the ability for everyone to enjoy those shared natural resources. So I think while there are always improvements that could be made and perhaps examples you could point to where regulations might not have been implemented perfectly, the idea of just simply deregulating for the sake of making business easier isn't always a sound decision. There's a false scenario that's put up that the environment and the business don't work hand in hand, but really it's not true. Good business and a good, healthy environment work together and build on each other.
Paul, is it going to be a challenge to do the kind of research that, say, the DNR used to do without being the DNR, without having the institutional resources, the easy access to data? Is it going to be possible to do productive research?
Well, I don't see this organization as doing frontline research. What we're more going to be is a way to convey the existing knowledge out there that's already been developed inside DNR and in academic institutions, and getting that to decision makers. Being that many of us were working for agencies for a long time, we have the connections, we know where the information resides, and so we won't be generating it so much as identifying it and sharing it.
And Terry, have you gotten any response, formal or informal, from the DNR about Greenfire?
Not really. I mean, we've heard from folks within the agency who are interested in what's going on, people who are there who might particularly be frustrated with things that they're no longer allowed to do or needs that they see that aren't being met. But nothing from the top-level management. We've heard a lot from the public and from other resource management professionals who are excited about this program and really glad there's going to be a non-political science advocacy group out there that they can go to.
And Terry, you've said elsewhere you don't want Greenfire to be a long-term mission. You don't want this to be a permanent group. What would you need to see to say, okay, we are not needed anymore?
Well, I think what we'd all like to see is a return to sound science-based management and a welcoming of science into discussions about public policy and resources, and a flourishing of educational material that's available to the public so we can all be involved as good citizens in managing our resources, all together with the politicians, with the policymakers, and the staff at the agencies.
Terry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Paul, glad you could join us.
Well, it was a pleasure to be here.
We've been talking to Terry Dalton and Paul LaLiberty. They're members of Wisconsin's Green Fire, a group of retired conservationists getting back in the game, aiming to protect and promote the state's environment. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Tomorrow morning on the Joy Cardine Show after 8, we get two perspectives on state and national news on the Week in Review with the latest on Hurricane Harvey's recovery, the state budget, and other top stories of the week. That's tomorrow morning after 8 on the Ideas Network.
Now, President Trump made a pitch this week for a major tax reform, saying he wants to work with Congress on a plan. Here's the president speaking in Missouri.
So this is our once-in-a-generation opportunity to deliver real tax reform for everyday, hardworking Americans. And I am fully committed to working with Congress to get this job done. And I don't want to be disappointed by Congress. Do you understand me?
The president gave few specifics during his speech for sweeping tax overhaul, but he did seem optimistic that he could work with Congress to get something passed.
Chai Ching Wong is the deputy director of federal tax policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She joins us now to dig into what we know about the president's push for tax change. Chai Ching, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I know we don't know. There's not a plan, really. There's not a lot of details out there. But from what the president has been saying, what kind of changes is he calling for?
So I think it's really, really pretty striking in that the speech really just repeated a number of the strong promises that we heard from him throughout the campaigns and in his administration. You heard from that clip just then that he's saying that tax reform should focus on raising the incomes of workers and their families, and not for those at the top. It was something that he emphasized in his speech. And, you know, I agree, tax reform should prioritize working and middle-income families that have seen sluggish growth in their incomes in the past few decades. I think what's disappointing is that he did nothing to close the gulf between those promises and the actual specific policies that we have seen that he's announced that really wouldn't address the concerns of low- and middle-income people and would instead deliver a lot of tax cuts, costly tax cuts, to those at the very top.
One of those tax cuts, and here's one where he did give a number, slashing the corporate tax rate down to 15%, down from 35%. I'll put an asterisk on 35%. I understand many corporations pay less than that. But what would that corporate tax rate change mean for businesses and the economy?
So I think that asterisk is really important. This is something he likes to point out, that that's a very high rate relative to other countries. And he's right when you look at the statutory rate. But the thing is, when you take into account all the tax breaks and loopholes that corporations pay, the actual U.S. corporate tax rate is very similar to other developed economies. So it's around about 28% for U.S. multinational firms, and that's pretty comparable to the 29% that other G7 developed countries pay. So when you take that into account, and when you look at the fact that corporations are doing pretty well in the economy at the moment, a lot of them are posting record profits and paying out a lot in dividends and share repurchases to their investors, a large corporate rate cut is really not a great way to go about creating jobs and growth. a lot of that cash would simply flow through to the hands of shareholders rather than be reinvested. And that is a really, really costly policy. That's a big part of his plan that would cost about $3.5 trillion.
Looking at the tax system as a whole, I think the word complicated is a fair word to use. There's a lot of moving parts. Is there a need, regardless of the details, is there some kind of need to simplify the tax system in the United States?
I think that most tax policy analysts and most people that sort of fill in their tax forms at the end of the year would agree that a simpler tax code would make a lot of sense. Unfortunately, that's another one of these areas where the promises don't match the policies all that much. There are a lot of good ideas for simplifying the tax code, but one of the headline policies from both the Trump administration and the congressional GOP would be to open up large new tax loopholes that would encourage new different shelters and complex arrangements to avoid the top income tax rate, because people would have an incentive to reclassify their income in order to get a new special tax rate that would apply to certain types of businesses. So, again, it's one of these areas where the policy goals are really attractive and something that a lot of people can agree with, but unfortunately all the detail that we've seen is a long way off it.
Chai-Ching Wong is with us from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, looking at the president's call for a major overhaul of the tax system. The details we know so far, the details we don't know so far. Chai-Ching, again, based on what we've heard from the president, what other impacts would this have on the top income earners, the wealthiest people in the country?
Well, they would do very, very well out of this plan. The estimates from the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center are that someone in the top 1%, that's someone that has an average income of $7 million each year, could see a tax cut of between $900,000 and $1.4 million, depending on which version of the Trump tax plan you look at. And then it's true that middle-income families would get a tax cut, but it really pales in comparison to what's going towards the top. Someone who's in the middle fifth of the income distribution, so has an income of about $58,000, they'd get a tax cut of about $700 to $2,000. So while the top 1%, 0.1% could see their incomes go up by a full fifth from the tax cuts, those in the middle would see their incomes go up by a few percent. And that doesn't take into account who ends up picking up the tab for the tax cuts, because eventually, if they're not paid for, either sooner or later, the deficits that they create have to be addressed.
Now, the argument from the president and others is that if we lower some of these high-end tax rates and this corporate tax rate, wealthy people, business owners are going to look on this world market and say, hey, the United States looks pretty competitive. I'm not going to get hit too hard with taxes. Things are simpler now. I understand what I'm getting into when it comes in, when it comes to taxes. I'm going to open up my factory in the United States instead of elsewhere. That ultimately is going to drive up incomes for middle and lower income Americans. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think it's important, again, to take a look at, you know, while there's no fully fleshed out bill, the president has put out tax policies, and one of the most recent things that he said that he would do, which is actually a reversal from something that he said in the campaign, is that for large multinational companies, companies that are based in the U.S., they would get a 0% tax rate on the profits that they earn offshore. So this would create a big incentive for those big multinationals, you know, big tech companies, big pharma companies, to report their profits as having been earned not in the U.S. where they're selling most of their goods, but in some other country, in order to get that 0% tax rate. And there's even a greater danger that they could actually move their investment and jobs offshore in order to take advantage of that lower tax rate. So, again, I think the desire for a competitive tax system, the desire for jobs and growth is really, you know, a good policy goal. But looking at the details that we have seen, the gap remains between those promises and what the details are.
Again, from what we've heard, what do we know about how this would affect smaller businesses?
That's a that's a really great question. So one of the key proposals that both President Trump and the congressional Republican leadership have made, made it a centerpiece of their tax plans, is a special low tax rate that they're saying is for small businesses. It's for so-called pass-through income that's reported on individual tax returns. And they say that this is a really important thing for small businesses. Again, looking at the details, though, most small businesses are, in fact, already small, so they already face lower tax rates. And more than 98% of them wouldn't get a benefit at all from this new special tax cut. Instead, most of the income that would get this new tax cut is earned by hedge fund managers, lawyers, consultants, investment managers, big real estate investors who hold most of that pass-through income and are in the top tax brackets at the moment.
One issue that's been bouncing around out there for, I don't know, at least 20 years, probably longer, is the estate tax. Is that something that's covered in what the president has said?
Yes, he has repeatedly said that he would repeal the estate tax. Again, this is portrayed by both the president and by congressional Republican leaders who also want to repeal the estate tax as something that would be very beneficial for small businesses and for farmers. The reality is, though, that at the moment, the estate tax exempts the first nearly $11 million of the value of an estate. So if you're a couple, you have to have more than $11 million to even face the tax. So it only benefits households with incomes above that level. And at the moment, that's the richest 2 out of every 1,000 estates in the country. Estimates from the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center is that those estates only include 50 farm or business estates every year, and that there has been no instance that a number of different investigative reporters have been able to find of any farm or small business actually having to be sold in order to pay the tax. So this is really about the heirs of the very wealthiest estates in the country rather than real farm and small business estates.
Chai-Ching Wong is with us from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. We're looking at the next steps in the proposed overhaul of the U.S. tax code.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to be done to simplify the tax code? Would a lower corporate tax rate be good for the economy and for workers? Let us know by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about a possible overhaul of the U.S. tax code. President Trump on the campaign trail, in effect, calling for big changes in taxes in the United States. Chai-Ching Wong is with us. She's Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What challenges do you think lie ahead as the GOP tries to change the country's tax system? Do you think lower taxes on American businesses would lead to higher wages for workers? And what would help you and your family when it comes to taxes? You can join us at 800-642-1234 or by posting at the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go to our callers now. Terry is on the line in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi. My thought, and I've been mulling over this for months, and I don't know why, but Republicans want tax reform. Democrats want, better health care. Why can't this be part of a big grand bargain and actually have a serious conversation about these two things? Because if we keep going back and forth idealistically on both sides of Democrats want this and Republicans want that, if we don't come to the middle on both of these topics, we're going to keep fighting each other over the same things over and over again.
Terry, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, do you see maybe a good compromise package out there, Chai-Ching, that if both sides were able to get together, we could have something that A, simplify the tax code, and B, help lower and middle income Americans, as the president says he wants to do?
I think over the years there have been some common areas where there have been overlap. But unfortunately, what we see going into this round of an attempt at tax reform is that congressional Republican leaders have been very clear that they are going to try to move this on a partisan basis. So they're setting up to use a process through Congress called reconciliation. And all that really means is that they can pass it through Congress without a single Democratic vote in the Senate. That really relieves the pressure to try and build a bipartisan package. And we haven't really seen any attempt at a bipartisan tax package at this stage.
Thanks for the call, Terry. We'll go next to Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks so much. My comment, although I loved the previous caller, what he just said about people getting together and compromising and doing some big things for the country. Again, Donald Trump can't sign legislation that he's not given. It's Congress that's broken. Congress is a swamp, and we need to drain the swamp of people who won't compromise and won't bring things forward. I mean, Donald Trump is trying to do health care. The tax thing should be easy. We should get it done, and it should be a bipartisan compromise because that's the best thing for the country. Thanks so much.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Maybe not as easy, though, at least given what Congress looks like now, Chai Ching. Are there examples we can look to in the past where Congress has made an effective change to the tax code that could apply today?
Look, there have been bipartisan packages in the past in which there have been tax packages enacted that do the sorts of things that would actually meet the promises that President Trump set out in his speech, focusing on working and middle-income families. Both Republican and Democratic presidents have signed into law tax bills that increase tax credits for working families that would directly boost their incomes rather than relying on corporate tax cuts to trickle down to them. So that's the sort of solution that I would like to see Congress and the president focus on. Again, unfortunately, the plans we've seen to date have not gone in that direction. The other thing I would just like to note in response to that caller is that actually in the tax area in particular, there is a lot of commonality between what the Republican Congress is laying out in its tax plans and what President Trump has called for. So both of their plans have large cuts in the corporate tax rate. Both of them would create a 0% rate for foreign profits. Both of them would cut the top tax rates for high-income families, and that's where the bulk of their costs would go. So this is a case where actually, at least from a policy perspective, the president and the Republican Congress are very much on the same page.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Chai Ching Wong is with us from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, looking at the prospects for a major overhaul of the tax system. President Trump calling on Congress to get rolling on that. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'd very much like your expert to comment on my statements. I'm rejecting the previous caller's comments. The last 25 years in American economic policy have been what Jesse Jackson used to call Robin Hood in reverse. We have seen a stagnation of wages and income of middle income and working class families and a vast increase of the wealth of the upper crust of the United States. It is specifically seen by the change of 6,000 in the Dow to 21,000 with no benefit to the working Americans. I'd be interested in your guest comments on that.
Jim, thanks for the call. Chai Ching, what do you think?
I agree, and that's why I think there's a lot in what President Trump laid out as his policy goals for people to be attracted to, because he does identify the fact that there has been that stagnation in low and middle income households. The problem is that the policy prescription that he's laid out is really more of the same trickle down that we've seen really not work previously. After the large tax cuts under President Bush, job growth was weaker than under the tax rates that were moderately higher under President Clinton, for example. And we've seen it recently in Kansas, where large tax cuts flowing to the top did not deliver the promised supercharged growth. And in fact, Kansas's economy lagged behind its neighboring states and the nation. And what happened in the end was that to fill those deficits, Kansas actually had to cut or delay investments in things like infrastructure and education, closing schools after 4 days in the week in order to make up that budget shortfall. And that's not the sort of thing that strengthens the economy or creates jobs or stronger wages for working Americans.
Jim, thanks for the call. I wanted to talk about the federal deficit issue. Again, based on what we've seen so far, what would you see as the deficit impact if these tax cuts aren't balanced out by other revenue or by spending cuts?
Yeah, that's really, I think, the big problem for working and middle-income Americans. It's not what's offered in the particular tax package up front, but if there are trillions of dollars being spent on tax cuts for corporations and very high-income people, the question is who pays for that in the end. President Trump's tax plans would cost between $3.5 and $7.8 trillion over 10 years, depending on which version of his plan you look at. And about a third to two-fifths of that goes just to millionaires. So the overall tilt and cost is really big. The Congress could, in the process that they're about to embark on, choose to try to offset some of that cost by scaling back loopholes and other tax breaks. We haven't seen any specific policies that would cover that cost, unfortunately. So then the question is, does the burden of filling that hole come onto the spending side of the budget? And what we've seen in President Trump's budget and the GOP budget is that there are deep, deep cuts in domestic investments, things like things like infrastructure over the long run that would be cut, things like education, job training, a whole range of priorities that help the economy. And even if they were to put the tax cut on the deficit to start with, that deficit hole has to be filled eventually, and that will create pressure for cuts or underinvestment in the future.
Chai Ching, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Chai Ching Huang. She's Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She joined us for a look at the president's call for a major overhaul of the tax system. He is leaving a lot of the details to Congress. You can still share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. What do you hope to see happen? What are you worried about? What kind of changes would you like to see? What would you not like to see? Share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a look at the latest news in the ongoing Russia investigation with new revelations about contacts between Russia and members of the Trump campaign team and the involvement of a state attorney general in the investigation.
We'll find out how working dogs are helping to protect livestock around the state of Wisconsin.
And on Food Friday, our guest chef will be on hand to tell us how to grill seafood, making it delicious without burning it and making the last little bit of grilling season come alive.
Hopefully they can help overcome some of my fears about grilling. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.